On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's veto time in Washington. The president is saying no to pullout dates from Iraq. Next up, Congress will almost surely demand at least hard benchmarks to show progress by the Iraqi government. But the White House is saying no to that, too. A glimpse from Baghdad shows why. The government of Nouri al-Maliki is in trouble. Hardline Shiites leaving the cabinet, Sunnis now threatening to bail, no benchmarks being hit, and plenty of resentment of pressure from Washington for speed. Up next on Point, missed benchmarks and nobody home in Baghdad. The view from the Green Zone. We'll hear in a moment from former Assistant Secretary of Defense Lawrence Korb, who's just back from Iraq. But first, joining me from Baghdad is Sudarsan Raghavan, the Washington Post's Baghdad bureau chief. Sudarsan Raghavan, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
You've written a lot about benchmarks and the Iraqi government. Benchmarks, of course, were front and center when the Bush administration was selling the surge of U.S. troops into Baghdad. What's happened with that big list of benchmarks that were put forward by Nouri al-Maliki, Condoleezza Rice, cited by President Bush? What's happening on them?
Well, almost all of the key political benchmarks are, there's been little progress or no progress on any of them. And so that really raises issues of whether or not the Iraqi government can actually pass legislation along sort of the time frame that the Bush administration wants. I mean, there's several reasons for this. They're fractured. The government's fractured by personality and sect. The Shiites, in particular, are mistrust U.S. intentions, U.S. efforts to bring Sunnis into the political process as an attempt to weaken their power. Some Iraqi politicians see this outright bullying, pressure tactics by the administration. I mean, what we're seeing here really is a widening disconnect between sort of the Bush administration and the Iraqi politicians' views on how to shape Iraq's future. When you talk with Iraqi politicians across the political and sectarian spectrum, I mean, they talk about how it is unrealistic for the politicians in Washington to expect such key legislation be passed by the end of the summer. They literally see their own political process being hijacked by what's unfolding in Washington.
And yet we have even Republicans in Washington, Senator Sam Brownback, saying over the weekend, we've got to get more aggressive on pushing the political solution. Sudarsan, remind us of the key benchmarks. There's a long list that have been proposed and promised by the Baghdad government, but why are these so important? What are the key moves that Washington and Iraqis are waiting on?
Well, there are three key political benchmarks, you might say, right now. The first one is laws concerning the sharing of oil revenues. The second one is over on how to deal with thousands of members of the former regime of Saddam Hussein, whether or not to let them into certain jobs and equivalent jobs into the government. And last but not least is the whole issue of constitutional revisions, which has been probably the biggest sticking point in this whole issue. There are deep divisions on every one of these laws. Although of all three of these benchmarks, the oil law certainly seems to be the easiest one that could be passed. But in Iraq, nothing is ever easy.
So is anything happening? Are these pushing forward? Are they waiting indefinitely? And if they do, can peace be possible in Iraq?
Each one of these benchmarks, they're sort of in different stages, but none of them have been, have been decided for a vote in Parliament. That's where the real battle happens, is going to happen, because the Parliament is so fractured. What we're also seeing is the stage that the government appears to be getting weaker and weaker. Just yesterday, the largest Sunni bloc of politicians threatened to pull out of the cabinet. And just 2 weeks ago, we had the six cabinet ministers loyal to Shiite cleric Muqtada Sadr pull out of the cabinet. So a lot is being expected out of a government that is increasingly fractured, and particularly in the parliament, and everyone has different views over how and different demands on what these benchmarks should reflect, what needs to be done.
And just for clarity on the calendar, I'm looking here at a timeline that Condoleezza Rice put out. It's called a notional political timeline for all these benchmarks, and it looks to me as though all of the deadlines for these things to have happened have now passed, or nearly all of the important ones. Is there any calendar for these for the action by the Iraqi government on these key steps, or is it just in limbo now?
Well, you know, there are obviously calendars coming from politicians in Washington, but the Iraqis have their own calendar, and you know, when you talk to them, one Iraqi politician told me how, you know, we never say yes to timelines. Everything is inshallah, God willing. So the Iraqis are moving forward. I mean, they realize that reforms need to be made. They're not disputing that.
Yep.
And they agree it needs to be done, but they're saying that given Iraq's reality, they need to pursue it on their own timeline, not Washington.
Sudarsan Raghavan in Baghdad. I guess a last question. Any further word on this alleged head of al-Qaeda in Iraq, al-Masri, whether he's dead or alive? Iraq's interior ministry is saying both things we're hearing today. What have you heard?
Yeah, it's the same situation right now. It's very murky. The government is saying that the intelligence reports indicate that he has been killed, but at the same time, U.S. military officials and other government officials are saying that they cannot confirm it. They have yet to see a body. One military spokesperson even said that it might take a few days, if there is a body, to take a few days to even determine from a DNA sampling whether or not al-Masri was killed or not. So everything is still up in the air as of this moment.
Sudarsan Raghavan, Washington Post bureau chief in Baghdad, in Iraq. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Let's listen now for just a moment to Face the Nation on Sunday. Here was Bob Schieffer talking with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. She said that conditions on funding or having consequences for missing benchmarks in Iraq limit the government's flexibility. She doesn't want penalties or requirements for benchmarks.
The benchmarks that are there are benchmarks that were set by the Iraqi government. So they're benchmarks that they know they can meet, should meet. We've been working with them and telling them that our patience isn't limited. But the problem is, why tie our own hands in using the means that we have to help get the right outcomes in Iraq?
No, they should meet, but are not meeting. We're joined right now from Washington by Lawrence Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. Recently back from a tour of Iraq, most of it, maybe all of it, in Baghdad, looking at the country's government there. Lawrence Korb, thanks very much for being with us.
Nice to be with you again, Tom.
You're just back from your most recent trip to Baghdad. You sat and talked with a lot of people in the Baghdad government. Does Washington have a partner there, or is this an illusion, or are these simply bodies on different timelines?
Well, I think they are different timelines, as Mr. Raghavan said. I mean, the Iraqis do not understand how American people are losing patience with them, and American people want to see some action. They have no sense of urgency. It could be for the reasons Mr. Raghavan talked about. But, I mean, in addition to the internal problems they have, they talk sometimes. The parliament was talking about, we're going to take 2 months off this summer. Now, maybe they won't. But the fact that they'd be talking about that, to me, was just mind-boggling, given what's happening. The fact is, the Minister of Planning, who was the person who asked me to go over there, basically he was in Denmark when I got there, and I thought, well, what are you doing in Denmark when your country seems to be falling apart, and your job is to improve the capacity or the effectiveness of your government?
Just for starters, then, I mean, it's so hard from this side of the planet to really understand. You've got people claiming, the U.S. government claiming they know what they need to do, they're going to do it. You've got others claiming, you know what, the whole government is a farce. There isn't really a government in Iraq. In that spectrum, what did you see? Where do you come down?
Well, closer to no government. Mr. Maliki is not a very dynamic leader to begin with, and his hands are tied. I mean, because no matter what he does, he's going to antagonize some people, and his main goal seems to me to keep himself in power. I mean, yesterday, for example, we learned that he is relieving some of the more aggressive Iraqi generals who are going after some of the militias. And so he basically is more interested in keeping himself in power rather than, you know, it seems to me, the future of Iraq as a stable, democratic, unified nation.
Do the members of the Iraqi government that you spoke with feel the heat, the pressure from Washington? Do they know the intensity of the debate there and the focus on timetables, calendars, moving?
Well, in fact, they don't. In fact, when you try and push them, they resent it. It's like, you know, they'll tell you, well, we're a sovereign government. So, you know, we're going to do what we think, and you people thousands of miles away, different culture, don't understand, which is correct. The problem is that they're relying on us to buy them this time. And I think the patience of Americans is running out. And it's also hurting our long-term security interest as we basically keep more and more brave young men and women there and do long-term damage to our army as well as our ability to deal with other situations around the world.
Lawrence Korb, listen with me for a second, if you would, to General David Petraeus, who, of course, was in Washington last week, saying that there's only so much that the military, the U.S. military, or any other can do.
Success in the end will depend on Iraqi actions. As I noted during my confirmation hearing, military action is necessary, but not sufficient. We can provide the Iraqis an opportunity, but they will have to exploit it.
General David Petraeus, military action necessary but not sufficient. Lawrence Korb, I wish you'd take us in with a little more intimacy into some of your conversations with people in the Iraqi government. Do they feel that they're on a slow path toward these benchmarks, key steps that need to be taken to pull the country together? It just doesn't line up with the U.S. path. Or are they not on a path at all? Is it just a kind of, you know, floating, amorphous status there?
Well, basically what they feel is they can do enough or make some moves in order to placate us, but you don't get the feeling that they're really going to undertake some of the things that Mr. Raghavan, the Washington Post bureau chief, you know, told you. I mean, for example, okay, they got the hydrocarbon law, the fuel distribution law, to the parliament.
That is so that all the different sects can share in the oil revenues. Sunni's worried they won't have any. Kurds worried that it'll be taken away from them. Everybody wants that nailed down, or some do anyway.
Right. But one of the reasons the executive branch was able to do that is because they knew that the parliament was not going to act on it anytime soon and would protect their interests. So if I'm in the cabinet and I'm a member of one of the sects and Shia or Kurds, I'll say, okay, sure, let it go to the legislature because I know my people in there will prevent it from happening. Because the members of the parliament basically, I mean, we didn't have an election. We had a census. I mean, all the Kurds voted for Kurds, the Shias for Shias, and the Sunnis for Sunnis. So those legislators, members of parliament, have no incentive to cut across lines at all. In fact, they know if they do, the next time there's an election, they're going to be out. So, I mean, that's what you get, that they sort of know that. But their feeling is, look, the United States will never leave here because they feel that they have interest here. And that's why I'm more and more, you know, convinced that unless you set a deadline, they're not going to know we're serious. Because if I'm an Iraqi and I listened to Secretary Rice last Sunday, I'll say, gee, they gave us these benchmarks a couple of months ago. Now she's saying not going to rush. So I got more time. I'll, you know, take a month off of here or something and get back to this. Because these are tough issues. And they know, Maliki knows, if he takes on these hard issues, his government's liable to fall.
So the cabinet can pass an oil revenue sharing law, and the White House celebrated when it did, but it's not going through the parliament. Another big one here is whether or not former Ba'athist members of the government, that is under Saddam Hussein, should be allowed to come back in. Of course, they were booted out not long after the invasion, and many people see that wholesale booting out as the fuel that got the insurgency really turbocharged. Is there any progress on allowing some of them back in enough that it might calm the waters of the insurgency, Larry Korb?
That's not even gotten through the cabinet yet. And one of the reasons is the Shias are opposed to it because, in their view, it was the Ba'athists that did all those horrible things to them. And you may remember when this first came up, our old friend Chalabi there was quoting the Ayatollah Sistani, saying, you know, he disapproved of it. Then the Ayatollah spokesman said, well, not quite. But again, you've seen nothing, no movement on that at all.
And what about the broader constitutional changes? Our former Ambassador Khalilzad worked very hard to get Sunnis into the Iraqi government by promising them that they'd come back to the constitution, which I guess everybody sees is flawed now, certainly from a Sunni perspective. They'd come back and work on that. Now we hear a big sect of Sunnis may walk out of the cabinet. Any progress on the constitutional changes that everybody agrees have to be made to get the Iraq community back in, under the tent?
No, there's not. And again, that was one that when Ambassador Khalilzad got the Sunnis to support the constitution in the fall of 2005, they said within 4 months after the new government took over, they would do that. That's over a year ago. So the Sunnis are basically saying, you know, we did this on the promise that you, the Americans, would get the government to make these changes, and they have not done them at all. And what you're seeing is for each month that they delay on this, you lose a battalion's worth of soldiers and Marines either killed or wounded.
So there you were. You were in the green zone and the red zone, the outside the walls part of Baghdad. You sat down on the floor, Iraqi style, and ate lunch with your fingers with Iraqi bureaucrats and government people. What's their vision of what's going on here?
Well, their vision, basically, you get the sense that, well, this will all work out in the end. We all have to be patient. And they will tell you, look how long it took the American government, you know, from our Articles of Confederation and the Constitution. And so that's their view that, and they'll even point out, look, you people had to have a civil war. So, you get this feeling of, okay, maybe over the next 10, 20, 50, 100 years we'll get this out. But, you know, we got a lot of problems. We have a history of colonialism. And so, you know, you got to give us more and more time. But when you talk about how much time, you don't get that answer. You don't get this sense of urgency. And that's what I came away with the most. And I think, as Mr. Raghavan pointed out, you can understand that. The problem is, with that sense of urgency, more and more Americans are getting killed, and our national security position in the world becomes weaker and weaker.
Condoleezza Rice says we need the flexibility of not setting penalties if they don't hit the benchmark, saying the president will not go for that. But then even here's Republican House Minority Whip Roy Blunt saying just a couple days ago, we need to get some better results from Iraq, politically, economically, militarily, and that needs to happen in the foreseeable future. That from Roy Blunt. Let's take some calls here from Quincy, Massachusetts. Mudafa, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Well, what do you know?
First thing, so I'm from Iraq myself, mm-hmm. and the government is ineffective due to the policy of balance United States forced Maliki government to achieve.
The policy of balance between Sunni, Shia, and Kurds.
Yeah, the Kurd has the greatest advantage. I mean, they are not in trouble at all. The struggle is between the Shiite and the Sunni. This is why the government, which has no real power, has no effective work to do. The second thing, I think there is a misdiagnosis of the discussion here.
Okay.
Sunni are not after the oil or distribution of the oil or wealth or whatever. Sunni insurgents are the reality in the Sunni neighborhood. They are controlling the neighborhood. Even the Sunni politician in the parliament, they're trying to appeal to the extremists more than the moderate. So,
but if the Sunni were guaranteed a piece of the oil revenue pie, wouldn't that take some of the steam out of the Sunni insurgency?
They already guaranteed it. They already guaranteed it. But look what happened. What happened is, among them, whoever tried to be more rational than extreme got killed. And you could see the events that some of the Sunni in Ramadi, the prominent Sunni, got killed. So the reality is you have a sectarian war led by Al-Qaeda who deny the existence of the Shiite. It's not about constitution. It's not about the struggle of power. It's not about anything else.
So is it just a military problem then? General Petraeus says no. He says it's political. It's not military alone in the end.
General Petraeus and the Bush administration look at it as a subject of a study. It's not realistic. And the problem is your reporting is totally different from the reality in Iraq. Reality in Iraq, Adamiya, for example, is controlled by Al-Qaeda. Amiriya, for example, is controlled by Al-Qaeda. Those Sunni politicians who were former Ba'athists, anyway, are not interested in getting the danger or getting threatened by Al-Qaeda.
Mudafa, we're trying our best in the fog of war here. We appreciate your contribution. Thanks for calling in. Lawrence Korb, stand by for just a moment, if you would. I want to go to Washington also, to Noam Levy, congressional correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, to look at what's likely to follow a Bush veto of the current funding bill. Noam, thanks a lot for being with us.
Hi, Tom. My pleasure.
So it appears as though next up on the docket is, okay, if the Democrats and a couple of Republicans have to stand down on pullout dates, they're going to go to hard benchmark dates. Are they likely to come back to the president with yet another bill that he's going to be unwilling to sign on funding?
Well, that's the big question. There's a lot of discussion going on now on Capitol Hill about what shape a second supplemental funding bill for the war might look like. As you mentioned, one of the ideas that's being talked about is our benchmarks and setting some goals for the Iraqi government. The big question there, as you alluded, is whether or not those benchmarks will be accompanied by any kinds of consequences and dates. The president has made it pretty clear, and so have congressional Republicans, that they are very wary of attaching consequences, even if they're not strictly withdrawal provisions.
Let me ask you, over the weekend, President Bush was making noises that he's now prepared to talk with the Democrats. They're going to go to the White House, we're told, tomorrow to sit down for a powwow. Does it look as though there's some new room for conversation here, or is this just posturing before another straight standoff?
Well, I think it's more of the latter. You're right, the president did make some motions towards negotiation, but the two sides are upping up their rhetoric again at the beginning of this week. And today, as you know, is the fourth anniversary of the mission accomplished speech. Democrats will be heading to the floor of the House and Senate to make the point that 4 years later, the mission is still not accomplished, and the White House, the president, and his GOP allies continue to attack Democrats in their view, pushing for a withdrawal and a defeat. So I wouldn't expect a love fest anytime soon.
And Noam, what about Republican solidarity on this? You can see the strain in people's faces. The polls are not at all favorable. American support, public support for the war. Is there any evidence that Republicans may get chipped off in greater numbers here and actually themselves begin insisting on hard signs of progress from the Iraqi government?
Well, there are, Tom. I mean, the signs thus far are more subtle. When the votes occurred last month on the supplemental funding bill that included the withdrawal dates, only four Republicans crossed the aisle to vote for those, two in the Senate and two in the House. So on the surface, it appears that the White House has been pretty successful in holding Republicans together. But I think as the summer wears on, we're going to see Republicans getting increasingly nervous. There are signs already that if you just listen to some of the rhetoric that Republicans who just a month or two ago were saying no way to the kind of benchmarks Democrats are talking about now seem to be a little more open to it. And there seems to be a general consensus within Republican ranks that the president doesn't have an unlimited time here to prove progress, maybe the end of the summer, August, September at the latest, before the GOP chorus for change is gonna get pretty loud.
But is there a government in Baghdad capable of responding to that chorus, I guess, the question? Noam Levy, Lawrence Korb, let me take another call here, if I may. Subroto's calling from Boston. Subroto, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you. What do you see?
I have a comment leading on to a question.
Mm-hmm.
And my comment is, when I hear on the air or I listen to radio programs which say Iraqis are not meeting the benchmark, I get a sense of irritation because to me it means the Iraqi people, everyday people, are not meeting the benchmark. And I think that is so wrong.
Well, it's supposed to be a democracy now. I mean, the Iraqi people, Lord knows, they're up against it. But let's say, the government. Do they have some responsibility to step up, or are you saying it's all an American problem?
I am not saying it's an American problem. I think that's leading on to my question. I think we need to define that it's the Iraqi government that's not meeting benchmarks, because democracy as we see it does not work in the Middle East. It's time to say this government does not have the power or the capability to ever reach the benchmarks. And what I think we should be doing is to be talking to the sectarian leaders of the Sunni and the Shiite majority to involve them in the government and give them the responsibility.
Subroto, let us pick it up. Lawrence Korb, Subroto says they don't have the power or the capability to ever meet these benchmarks, but that's pretty bleak, because these are steps necessary, we're told, to hold the country together. What's the option? What's the alternative?
Well, the problem we have is that the Ayatollah Sistani pushed us to set up this Iraqi government. And remember that Ambassador Bremer probably agreed with your caller. He didn't want to move that quickly. We were pushed to set it up, and they're a sovereign government. So if the United States bypasses them, they're going to say, well, you're undermining our sovereignty. And the problem we have in this, I wrote after my first trip there back in November 2003, you weren't going to be able to get anything. It's going to take us 10 years to do it. And that's the problem. We don't have 10 years now. And even the Republicans by this time next year with the elections coming, I think are going to run out of patience.
But Noam, there's a sense in Washington that some Republicans are still in this for the long haul. And maybe they think somehow they do have 10 years. Do you pick up on that? We're still reading people saying it's going to take that long. We're just going to have to learn the patience here to deal with a long-term challenge in Iraq.
Well, there are a few, you know, Senator John McCain being the most conspicuous of that group, who I think genuinely believe that it's in the United States' best interest from a national security perspective to make that kind of a commitment. But, you know, you got to remember that there are a lot of politicians whose time frame is a lot shorter than that, and it's no secret to any Republicans here on Capitol Hill, or for that matter around the country, what happened in November when Democrats took control of the House and the Senate, in large part over frustration and impatience with the course of the war in Iraq. So while it is true there are a few, I think that many, many of them need to see progress before then. If for no other reason than that's what the American public expects, and that's who they represent.
Noam Levy, congressional correspondent in Washington for the L.A. Times. Noam, thanks very much for joining us.
Sure.
Larry Korb, just a couple seconds here before the break, but do we have a problem of clashing timetables here? Is the American public just out of sync with Iraqi reality, or vice versa?
Oh, very definitely. And General Petraeus has said the Washington clock is moving quicker than the Baghdad clock, and that's the problem that you have. You don't have 10 years. In fact, I would say the most you have is until next September.
Let's go to Waterloo, Iowa. And Don, hi, Don, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, Tom, for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to make a comment based on something that a gentleman said earlier. I think he was from Iraq. I feel that a big problem that the United States has with their trying to put a timetable on Iraq is the fact that there's a total cultural difference, and I don't think that you'll ever be able to get a situation where the sects that are trying to have control of that country and looking at their interests will ever come together and try and make decisions based on what's best for the country. And I'm wondering if the gentleman that went over there has looked at, or if there's been ever any talk about maybe a fundamental change in the way that they're looking at governing the country. Because I don't know as though with the cultural differences that they could ever come up with a true democratic process where the good of the country came before the good of the different sects.
Don, we've got it. It's an honest question and still an urgent one. Saddam Hussein, Larry Korb, overcame that with brute force. We had the vision. We had the vision here of something different, and Don wants to know, can it work?
I don't think so, and I think Don is right. And again, this is something we should have thought about before we went in. But remember, when we went in, we thought we'd be greeted as liberators. We thought that the Iraqis would all come together because they would be so grateful that we got rid of Saddam Hussein. And Don is right. We didn't understand the culture there. And then, of course, we made all kinds of other mistakes in terms of, you know, the debathification, disbanding the military, not sending enough troops, and we're paying the price for that now. And I think we don't have, in my view, you don't have any good options, and what you have to do is look at the least bad option that fulfills our moral obligation to the Iraqis as well as protects our security interests. And that's why I think you need to set a deadline. My colleague and I, Brian Katulis, have argued over the next 18 months, which would then keep us there more than 5 years, and also give them the only incentive I think we have to give them. And if they don't take it, it's really going to be their problem. And I think if you have a diplomatic surge as you leave, the countries in the region will be willing to work with you, because it's not in the interest of any of them to see Iraq become a failed state or a haven for terrorists.
But the pressure from Washington, to the extent that they're feeling it now, we heard earlier from Sudarshan Raghavan saying many in the Iraqi government feel bullied. I've read people in the government quoted recently saying, if the U.S. government is pushing for it, we're going to push against it. You know, the kind of nationalistic response to American pressure. Did you pick up on that in Baghdad, in the Green Zone or beyond?
Oh, very, very definitely. And that's why you can say, okay, fine, you're a sovereign country, you've got to make your own decisions. But the fact of the matter is we had 104 Americans die, you know, last month, and, you know, a couple of 100 more wounded. So therefore, we have a role in this. And if you want to deny our role, that's fine. Then we'll pull out and you're going to have to, you know, go on your own clock, and we will protect our interests in the region. We'll keep forces in Kuwait, in Bahrain, we'll keep the Marines on a carrier battle group in the area to protect, you know, to make sure the situation doesn't get out of hand. And then that's the dilemma, because you can't have it both ways. You can't say, you know, we're going to work with the Iraqis to do this if the Iraqis resent our pressure.
So is it your sense that the Iraqis resent the pressure, can't deliver on our timetable, but are gradually moving forward, or that there's really no there? That there's nobody home, nothing really going on in this government? Or is that an insult to, I don't know, lots of Iraqi, you know, bureaucrats working their hearts out?
Well, I think you have a lot of, bureaucrats or, you know, career people, I think, are trying to do a good job. It's the political leaders that basically are not doing what they need to do. I mean, just to give you an example, on my way over there, I read, you know, they had 34 ministries. By the time I left, it was like 38. I mean, what are they creating more ministries for? I mean, basically to give their friends and colleagues jobs. The deputy interior minister told me, you know, they're responsible for the police. It's not a question of training. It's motivation. I can't get them to come to Baghdad. They want to protect their own areas.
Does it come back essentially to that, to Shia, Sunni? We've got this report just in, yesterday of Iraqi soldiers, officers who had been very tough on rooting out Shiite militias being booted out of the military. We've got an American general here, Dana Pittard, saying their only crimes or offenses were that they were successful against the Mahdi army, Muqtada al-Sadr's group. You know, it looks as though the government may give lip service to the idea of tamping down all the militias and holding hands around a united Iraq, but in fact, a Shiite-dominated government still feels compelled to go out and boot people who are actually effective at doing that.
Well, that's correct, because Maliki knows, the prime minister, that he needs Sadr's 30 seats in the parliament to stay in power. So he's not going to go too hard. He'll pretend, or he'll move in a certain direction, but he won't do that. And that, you know, is your problem, because he's more interested in keeping himself in power than doing what's best for Iraq in the long run. And the military leads, when they see that, the other people are not going to push too hard at all. And in fact, some of them then will also cooperate with the Mahdi army and tip them off if, you know, American troops might start to move against them.
Let's go to Fred in Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I had a comment and maybe just get some feedback off the air. I was in Vietnam, and I see so many similarities in this conflict to what I saw in Vietnam. And I guess after hearing Condoleezza Rice on Sunday a little bit of what she said, I was wondering if Bush is just that stubbornness. He wants to not have benchmarks so he, I guess, can live out his presidency and, you know, say, well, I did all I could and leave it to somebody else. I just, you know, every time I think there's someone that says we need something as a gauge of what's going on, they tend to come back and say we don't want to have a gauge of a benchmark or anything else. And I'm wondering if it's just he's trying to just keep that so they can have it, you know, prolong it, at least say I didn't lose it.
Well, the president has said that this is something that will go on to the next president in all likelihood. But Fred, let me ask you, can you see a credible reason that Condoleezza Rice or the president might say, we can't have a date certain at the end of this because then our hands are tied. Give us the flexibility. We can't live without it. Can you see a strategic reason for that, Fred?
I can't. I don't understand why, you know, even when the report came out, why he didn't get questioned by a lot of the press, too, on, you know, who's he listening to come up with his strategies? I mean, everybody is saying this is not the way to go, and he's coming back and saying this is what my people are saying, the way we, you know, need to have the surge and, you know, give them an opportunity to get on their feet. And I just see so many similarities of this war to the Vietnam conflict that it just, you know, you can't win it when they don't want to win it on their own.
Fred, let us pick it up. Larry Korb, how about it? I'm just reading a former Marine major with two tours in Iraq, writing on the op-ed page of the New York Times this morning, saying, in effect saying, wise up, Americans. In fact, this is going to be a long war, and there is no good solution here other than to just hang in and hang in, maybe 10 years, maybe a dozen. You know, there's another view out there that says all this urgency for withdrawal misunderstands something fundamental about the conflict.
Well, I think that the Marine major is absolutely correct. And, you know, Fred is correct in the sense of, you know, talking about some of the similarities about Vietnam. The problem is that, you know, and let me quote Francis Fukuyama, the neoconservative, big initial supporter of the war, the book man who wrote the book The End of History.
Yeah.
And he said, if you had told the American people before you went to Iraq that you'd have now close to, you know, 3,400 people dead, Americans dead, 25,000 or so wounded, several hundred thousand Iraqis killed, and you're going to spend $500 billion so Iraq could have an election. These are his words. You'd have been laughed out of the ballpark, and that's the problem. You know, when you go to war and you tell the American people, okay, we need your support because here's the reasons. The reasons turned out not to be true. And here's what we, you know, the way we think it will go, and you get the support based on that, and the reasons turn out not to be true, and the strategy turns out not to be true, you can't blame the American people for wanting to say, okay, you know, you misled us, so, you know, we want you out. If we had been told, listen, we're going to go in there and this is a generational commitment, I think you might not have had the congressional vote to support it.
Knight is calling from Marblehead, Massachusetts. Knight, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
This program has certainly reviewed the enormous complexities of this situation. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I kind of keep coming back to is, you know, do we have a moral obligation here? And I imply that we do.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking of Colin Powell's comment about the Pottery Barn business, you broke it, you own it.
Mm-hmm.
There are millions of Iraqi people over here, and this country is pretty well busted up. Doesn't our commitment continue for some indefinite time in order to try to bring further help to these?
I mean, I understand that impulse, and certainly it was an American choice to go in there. But let me ask you kind of a philosophical question, but can one country own another country's civil war, if that's what it is? I mean, can you imagine the British having owned our civil war? Can you do it? Can you own that kind of core you know, structure of a country's war or peace, conflict or harmony?
Yes, well, I certainly not own it in the sense of ownership, but in the sense of helping to repair some of the damage that we've caused. I think we must have some kind of ongoing support system here.
Knight, we hear it. Larry Korb, what do you say, a moral obligation, and it's not over?
Well, I think we do have a moral obligation, and that's why we have urged, my colleague Brian Katulis and I, and the Congress is talking about getting out sometime in 2008. That will be over 5 years, so we haven't just cut and run. But I think, remember that we also have a moral obligation to our troops. We're sending troops over there now who are not ready. We're rushing them in. We're taking kids right out of basic training, putting them in units, going there, you know, to support the surge. So I think you have to balance, you know, balance that out. And in my own personal view, over 5 years is a reasonable way to for our moral obligation. And we have to balance all those, and there's no perfect solution. One Iraqi told me when I was over there, and it's true, he said, "You coming in here opened up the gates of hell for us." And there's no doubt about it, but we should have thought about that before we went in and made sure that the American people are on board.
Let's go to Michigan, East Lansing, and Kathy. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. My understanding of this is that Bush doesn't want to leave the country until he can get the Maliki government to sign this oil law. I don't know the exact name of it, but it's to turn the oil over, their national oil industry, over to like the OPEC group and leave hardly any for the Iraqi government themselves. They just want to open it up to privatization.
But there's still some debate about that we now read. But what's your conclusion or your insight there, Kathy?
Well, my insight is that, you know, that was the reason we went in, was for the oil in the very beginning, and that's why we won't leave, because we want that signed over to us. And we're not going to leave. Bush won't leave until he gets that signed.
Well, Kathy, our time is short. Let us pick it up. Larry Corbett, oil always comes back. They've got, the third largest reserves in the world. Does oil loom that large here now, though, or is the security problem even larger? I mean, we saw, what was 100-plus people arrested in Saudi Arabia last week, ready to attack oil fields and much else. Oil or security concerns, which is higher? Are they right up there together?
Well, I think it's security right now. There's no doubt about our fact that our interest in that part of the world, has to do with oil. But I think with the oil law, the hydrocarbon law, the main thing that we're interested in right now is that you balance it among the three main sects in Iraq, so each of them feels that they're going to get their fair share, which we hope would diminish some of their opposition to the creating of an Iraqi state.
Take us on the ground there. We've just got you for a couple minutes more. It wasn't your first trip to Baghdad. Just give us a visceral feel for what you saw, how it's changed, gotten better, gotten worse.
Very definitely, it's gotten worse. I was there in November 2003, and people thought that, you know, we had things well under control. But when you got there, you could see there was already signs of trouble. The insurgency was just getting going. But, I mean, if you go around Baghdad now, I mean, I didn't see all the areas, but, I mean, it's just horrible. There's garbage in the street. People are afraid to go out. The Americans are acting really as occupiers. I mean, when we had these, you know, convoys that take us to meetings, particularly on the other side of the Tigris, you know, we would move Iraqis out of the way, you know, go the wrong way on a one-way street. And I'm thinking to myself, if I'm an Iraqi, you know, I'm thinking, who do these people think that they are, you know, that they can, you know, just, you know, do this? And so you really get the feeling, and in fact, the polls show it, 60% of the Iraqis think it's okay to kill Americans. And they want us out because they realize that we're contributing to the violence, and I'm absolutely convinced that once we set a withdrawal date, you're going to find less violence because a lot of them who share different agendas are against our occupation.
Once we set a withdrawal date, but of course that's on the veto line right now. Do you think that's really going to happen?
No, I don't think under President Bush it will, but I think certainly the benchmarks, I mean, because he initially had agreed to the benchmarks, and as Condi Rice, I mean, in fact, some of the benchmarks that they set are not being met. And I don't
some.
See how
I mean, we're talking.
Can...
I mean, I'm looking here. September 06, not met. October 06, not met. December 06, not met. You know, January, February, March. Not, I can't see any met on this page.
That's right. And the Iraqis say, well, if there was no penalty, why do we need to do it? I mean, it's got to be some penalty. And if you don't, they're not going to get it. I mean, some of your earlier calls. It's an ineffective government, and an ineffective government is certainly not going to do things unless there's really, you know, you put this pressure on them. And that's why I've been convinced that unless you set a withdrawal date, they won't take you seriously. They'll say, Bush going to keep going because he doesn't want, you know, it's his legacy, so he's not going to do anything, so we won't do anything.
Well, it's not going to happen now, but we're grateful for the report from Baghdad. Lawrence Korb, welcome home. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Lawrence Korb, former Assistant Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan, now Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.